from last week. We were talking about the legacy of Michelin, and I began that segment by talking about how Michelin gets used in the Gemara, both for Agadata, lessons which are not about Halacha, but important ideas nonetheless. So we talked about the question of whether one should talk to people about their anxiety or put it out of their head, and both ideas being traced to the same verse in Michelin. We talked about a person not being afraid of the ultimate consequences of their actions and how that could lead to disaster. And then we also showed that Michelin is used as a basis for halacha, for Jewish law, in terms of rebuking somebody, scolding somebody, where they're not going to listen and accept your words, and also in terms of the requirement not to engage in activities where those activities are going to cause people to gossip about you or will strengthen the gossip about you. So Esther Bergman, who I don't see on yet, but hopefully she'll be on soon, asked a good question. We've identified three books in Tanakh that are Sifrei Halakha, Sifrei Emet, books of wisdom, as we call it, wisdom literature type books. I'm not sure why I said Sifrei Emet is different, sorry. Thinking about too many different things at once. The Sifrei Chochmah, the books of wisdom literature. One was Michelin, another was Koheles, and another was Iyov. So Esther asked whether we find the other two books of wisdom literature used for halacha. And I went looking, and the answer is yes. Not at great length, but we definitely do see some. There are some halachos, some laws that use sentences from Koheles, where that's not really part of the intent of Koheles. So, for example, there's a Gemara that talks about a mamzer generating a child with certain types of relationships such that the child is now illegitimate for certain purposes in Jewish law, and that's called me'uvas lo yuchal liskon. It is something that has been corrupted that cannot be set straight. There's nothing that you can do to make it up to the child and set things right afterwards. But that's not a case where Koheles is actually talking about a halacha or teaching a halacha, it's just borrowing a verse. So I wanted to go with something different. If you take a look on your sheet, you'll see two examples that I brought there. One is from chapter 5, sentence 4 in Koheles, where the sentence goes, and you don't need to look it up in your Tanakh because it's brought in the source, but the sentence goes, Tov asher lo tidor, misha tidor velo tishalem. Better not to take vows than to take vows and not fulfill them. That's the sentence in Koheles, which, you know, reasonable advice, consistent actually with some things that we see in the Chumash as well. If you take a look on the sheet, you see the way the Gemara in Chulin uses it. The Gemara there is talking about a different issue. In context, they're asking a question regarding language in a Mishnah. Sometimes a Mishnah describes an activity, and the question is it saying, by describing the activity, are you saying that it's an activity that people should engage in? Or are you saying this is the rule in the event that somebody engages in the activity? Is it what we call lechatchila? Go ahead and do this? Or is it only b'diavad, if you did this, then dot, dot, dot. How do I approach a Mishnah where it presents, where it describes an activity? So here they talk about a Mishnah which describes certain types of vows. I don't want to get into the specifics of the vows that we're talking about. It's not relevant for our conversation. But these are vows dedicating money to the Beis HaMikdash, to the temple. And I have a Mishnah that talks about who is eligible to take these vows. And the Gemara there asks, in source number 1, Hachinami d'lechatchila, when the Mishnah describes these activities, these vows, are you telling me that that's lechatchila, that one is actually supposed to take such vows? They quote first a verse from Chumash. There you are, Esther. We're talking about your question. Devarim chapter 23, sentence 23, which says, when you stop taking vows, you will not sin. Meaning, don't take vows and you won't sin. And then they quote a line from Koheles. That line, Tova shirlo tidor, misha tidor velo tishalem. Better not to take vows than to take vows and fail to fulfill them. So there is an example of them bringing a verse from Koheles as halacha, saying that, in fact, that line teaches me, no, you're not supposed to take vows. And when we talk about vows, it's in the sense of it being a bidyeved. If somebody did it, here are the laws, but not that you ideally should. Hang in there. I'm not taking questions yet. I want to show you the second example from Koheles first. This is a classic line in Koheles. Poreitz gader yishchenu nachash is the line. Somebody who breaks through a fence, who breaks through a boundary, will be bitten by a snake. Which you can take on a very literal level, right? You don't know what's on the other side of the fence. You knock down the fence, you don't know what's coming for you. But it's understood that it's, Koheles isn't saying that, you know, in this very, you know, concrete way. He's also saying, one who breaks through a rule may find that they stumble into something that the rule was meant to protect them from. You have rules that are meant to protect against problems, and you break the rule, you don't know what's going to happen to you. And the Gemara here uses that line in from Koheles in source number 2. It's more complicated than we really need to get into. I think I gave it to you on the sheet. I translated it there, but I'm just going to explain outside the text. The Torah says that you're supposed to say Shema when you lie down and when you rise up, which we understand to be about the time of day when you say it. You say it in the morning and you say it in the evening. Or to put it in the proper order, when you say it in the evening and then in the morning, right? People should not be lying down in the morning and then rising in the evening. That's that, unless they work the night shift. But the another way you could take that line, and I'm not going into all the ins and outs of it, but one way you could take that line is no. It's telling me that in the evening I'm supposed to say Shema while lying down, and in the morning I'm supposed to say Shema standing. It's actually giving me my posture, what position I should be in when I recite Shema. And you find in source number 2 that Beit Hillel said, the school of Hillel, who we follow for law, said, no, you don't adjust your physical position to say Shema lying down or standing up. It's just about the time of day. Whereas Beit Shammai, the school of Shammai, said, no, you actually are supposed to reflect the lying down or standing up with your posture when you say Shema. So Rabbi Tarfon tells the story. He says, I was traveling and I lay down to read Shema like Beit Shammai, and I put myself in danger from bandits. He's saying, like, you know, it was an amazing thing. I fulfilled this mitzvah even though it meant I was in danger. And the sages responded and said, you deserve to be liable for your life because you violated the words of Beit Hillel. Why are you following Beit Shammai? Forget endangering yourself. Why were you following Beit Shammai at all? And in the Gemara, they point out that, you know, missing Shema altogether would have been a failure to fulfill a biblical commandment. Whereas, by not fulfilling the words of the rabbis, this fence, they said he was liable for death. That's like that line, one who breaks a fence will be bitten by a snake. This was a lot clearer in my head before I put it on the page and tried to read it out loud now. But what I'm trying to get across to you, absent the Talmud Yerushalmi that you see here in source number 2, is that, again, here's a sentence in Koheles, the sentence being one who breaks through a barrier will be bitten by a snake, which does get used in legal contexts, and not only here, but as an overall legal philosophy. So just, you know, a little bit of an answer regarding Koheles for Esther. I'm going to go on to Eov as a source for these in a moment, but Ricky, you wanted to ask?
This might not be the place to discuss it. Can you hear me?
Yes.
It's a little funny. Anyways, why are vows so important?
So you're right. It's not the place to like go into it in depth, but essentially, vows are hugely important in Judaism because they are effectively the 614th mitzvah. In the sense that I can make a statement of I will do X or I won't do X, and Hashem honors that and makes it legally binding. So that now I am bound to do X. If I had taken a vow that I am going to, juggle for 15 minutes a day, that means my list of mitzvahs now includes a mitzvah of juggle, 15 minutes a day. So it's a very powerful thing. Hashem is effectively honoring our speech and honoring our creativity, and it comes with tremendous, tremendous risk, because failure to fulfill that is violation of a biblical law. It's not just like, well, I felt like doing it, now I don't feel like doing it. I violated a biblical law to uphold my words. So, vows become hugely important, both as a divine investment in the human being and the risks that come along with it.
What's the difference between a plan and a vow? If I say I'm going to go shopping today, but that's not a vow.
Right. So it's more of a commitment than a plan. Saying I am going to. That's why people, very often are careful to clarify that what they're saying is not a vow. And they'll say b'li neder, where they are worried that it might come across as an actual commitment. Janine.
Yeah. Thank you.
Sure. Janine, go ahead.
I just want to ask if the quoting who breaks a fence, is that given as the reason for the halacha, or is it more of an illustration how bad it would be to disregard the rabbis? I mean, do they base the halacha, do they say it's even worse because of these words, or is it just an illustration?
No, I think it's more of an illustration. It's an illustration
it's
of a
not
halacha.
Really, they mentioned
you're right.
Halacha, but it's not really a source for halacha. That's
okay, that's a fair statement. That's a fair statement. Gita, you were going to say? You're muted, though.
You explained very well your previous question. That was exactly what I was going to ask. In English, we have different levels of, I guess in Hebrew we do too, different levels of intent. I wish, I might, I would, I like to.
Yeah.
And we don't call them that. We don't think of them as vows.
Right. No, and one of the tricky things about vows is so much of it is subjective. And that's something that the Talmud wrestles with, the issue of people who say one thing and mean something else. Not just in terms of content, but in terms of seriousness and level of commitment to do whatever it was that they were talking about doing. All very true. In terms of Eov, so Eov is not usually used for halach. I think I mentioned that last week. However, we do find the book being, I'll say, borrowed for halachic purposes, not in terms of the statements in Eov, but in terms of the actions in Eov. I'll refer you to source number 3. We have a line in the Talmud towards the end of Brachos, which says that you're supposed to bless God for the bad, just as you bless God for the good. Terrible things happen, you also have to thank God for them. So the Talmud asks in number 3, "My chayev levarech al arok shem shemavarech al atova." What does that mean when it says you have to bless for the bad as one blesses for the good? And it goes on for a while. And then Amar Rava, the sage Rava says, "Lo nitzrucha ela lekabulinhu besimcha." What this means is that you have to accept whatever happens with joy. You have to accept whatever happens to you, even if it's bad, you have to accept it with joy. So Rav Acha quotes Rabbi Levi to say, "Mikra, where is there a verse that tells me that I have to accept it with joy?" And again, there's more that I'm skipping in the interests of space and time. But they quote the verse from Job chapter 1, sentence 21, in which it says, I gave it to you in the Hebrew, Hashem nasan v'Hashem lakach yishem Hashem mevorach. When Job suffers, he loses his family. He loses everything. And yet, he says, God gave, God took, may God's name be blessed. So that statement is an indicator of behaviors that human beings are supposed to follow. That's one example. Another classic example is in source number 4. Job's friends come to visit, and they stay with him for 7 days before they speak. They're silent for 7 days. And if you take a look at source number 4, Amar Rabbi Yochanan, Rabbi Yochanan said, Ein menachemin rashon lomar davar ad sheyiftach avel. The consolers are not allowed to speak until the mourner begins. Shenamar, and they quote this verse from what happened in Eov, where it says, then Eov opened his mouth, and only after that does it say, Eliphazef Teman responded and spoke and so on. So that teaches that one is supposed to be quiet when visiting, which, again, is brought as a halacha. Now, you know, we've talked about on other occasions, are there any Jews in this book of Job that you're teaching me a halacha, that you're teaching me a law? Not my point. Rather, my point is that there are actions that happen in the book that are taken as law, but I can't think of any passages that are actually statements that are used to teach halacha. Clear? Okay. So let's get back to...
Also, if something bad happens, I'm always thinking, well, it could have been worse. So when you're saying, okay, well...
That's not quite accepting it with joy. On the other hand, it may be the most somebody can do. So what we're going to do now is come back to Mishlei, because all of this was, you know, an interesting question, but we still have a lot to talk about in terms of the legacy of the book of Mishlei. So we've talked about usage in the Gemara, we talked about usage in the Midrash, and we started to talk about post-Tanakh literature. And specifically, we talked about the wisdom of Ben Sira. And we said that Ben Sira is a book that's written in Hebrew. It is credited by secular scholars to the early Second Temple period, early Second Beis HaMikdash. It's not in Tanakh. The Septuagint includes it. The Christians canonize it in their Bible. We do not have it in ours. And as we've already seen, the sages of the Gemara are well aware of it. They call it Apocrypha. They call it of the books of the outside. And they say, you can learn things that are good from it. Now, I should note, last time I gave a couple of Ben Sira quotes. So I got an email from somebody who is part of our class, but usually listens to the recordings. And he just notes, I'm going to quote from his email, rabbinic quotations from Ben Sira often differ from the early witnesses to his wisdom in Hebrew, Greek, and Syriac. So he believes that one of the quotes that we brought last time as being from Ben Sira is actually a little bit of a conflation of two different passages in Ben Sira. So worth noting and knowing. But in terms of Ben Sira, and we brought it last time, I wanted to just show you two things that I thought were very interesting. Actually, you know what? Sorry, he was commenting about source number 5, what we're about to read. This was very interesting, and it's worthy of note. Amale Rava la Rabba Bar Mari. The sage Rava says to the sage Rabba Bar Mari, Menaha Milsa de Amri Inchi. There's a line that people are wont to say. And I want to know, do we have a source for it? What people say is the following. Mitayel va'azil dikla bisha gabe kina desharchi. A bad palm tree wanders to empty nests. Meaning, bad goes with bad, is essentially the statement. You have a palm tree that doesn't produce dates, it's going to have nests that don't have birds. So Amar Lei, he replied, Rabba Bar Mari answered, Dabar ze kasuv ba Torah. You find that written in the Torah. Shanui b'nevi'im, it's repeated in the prophets. Mishulash ba ksuvim, it's a third time in the writings. Ksuvim. And it's in a Mishnah, and it's also in a Brisa. And then it goes on to show you all the different ways you can find this idea in Jewish literature. And the example that it brings for ksuvim, the writings is actually a passage from Ben Sira. Ben Sira number 13, or according to my emailer, perhaps an amalgam of Ben Sira chapter 13 and chapter 27, in which he says, Kol of lemino yishkon uvne adam ledomelo. Every bird will reside with its species, and people with those who resemble them. So the interesting thing here is that they're bringing a verse from Ben Sira as Ksuvim, which we've said it's not. It's not canonized in Tanakh. So that's a very interesting thing. The last thing I have to note about Ben Sira, and again, we're only here because Ben Sira is so closely resembles what you find in Mishlei. That's our point in discussing Ben Sira. It's clearly heavily influenced by Mishlei. But take a look at source number 6. I'm mentioning this. I am not explaining it because I can't. But I'm mentioning it. This is from the Maharil. The Maharil is one of the leading authorities in Ashkenazi Judaism in its formative centuries. A serious source of many Ashkenazi practices today. So this is a quote from him. Omar, he said, De Ben Sira hu hanolad mizera Yirmiyahu, that Ben Sira was actually born from the seed of Yirmiyahu, as in the prophet Yirmiyahu. So he's not the beginning of the Second Temple period. He now would be the end of the First Temple period, or the exile in between. Debas Yirmiyahu ha'iserochetzes achar avia be'ambati chamin. Because Yirmiyahu's daughter was bathing in a hot bath after her father had bathed there. V'kolta zera avia v'nis abra v'yolda. Evidently something had emerged from her father in the bath and it got absorbed in her and she became pregnant. And everybody said she was pious. When she was pregnant and she was not married, everybody said, this couldn't have been that she was involved with somebody. That can't be. So what happened? Well, there was this hot bath that her family used to frequent, and she became pregnant. She conceived that way. And so the child that she had became known as Ben Zera, the child of seed. And then when the kid grew up, it was a little unseemly to name him that. So they changed it to Ben Sira. Because Sira in Gematria is Yirmiyahu. Which is true. I did the math. I don't know what to do with that beyond, it's there on your page. Enjoy. It sounds like it is meant to simultaneously, give Ben Sira a remarkable pedigree of coming from the prophet Yirmiyahu. And also, at the same time, to say that there's something corrupt about him. That he was conceived in this way, and with this incestuous, basis for his existence. So, I'm not commenting on it, I'm not explaining it, I'm not doing anything other than saying, look, this is the news. Because you can't mention Ben Sira without noting that. Okay. There's another book which also has Shlomo's influence or Mishlei's influence called The Wisdom of Solomon. This book was originally written in Greek and it's traced to the first century before the Common Era. It is not in Tanakh. The Gemara does not deal with it. The Septuagint includes it and early Christians debated its status. But now I want to jump from that period of this, either Second Temple or end of the Second Temple period. I want to jump to the 11th century. In the 11th century, Spanish Jewry is led by a man named Shmuel Hanagid. This is in Muslim Spain, and he becomes very, very important in Muslim Spain. It's a fascinating story. This is when the Jewish community in Spain is really just starting to coalesce. Shmuel Hanagid is a student of Rav Hai Gaon, who is the last major Gaon. So Shmuel Hanagid, among other pursuits, wrote 3 volumes of poetry. One of them is called Ben Tehillim, religious poetry, as you might expect. One of them is called Ben Kohelet, poems about life and death. And one of them is called Ben Mishlei. It's not a commentary on Mishlei. It's meant to mirror the style of Mishlei. And I gave you a few examples here. I had them convenient to hand because some of you were in a class I taught at Beth Emeth many years ago in which we talked about Shmuel HaNagid, and there I brought them. So I had them ready. So if you take a look at source number 7, three lines out of his Ben Mishlei, three verses. One, Al na tehi chaver la rasha, gam al yehe rasha bechelkecha, ki hu Kihu Ele Risho Yeshivach Terem Tishiveyu Litzidkach. He says, be not a friend to the wicked. I tried to sort of mirror the style of the Hebrew. Be not a friend to the wicked. Also let not a wicked person be in your portion, for he to his evil will draw you before you draw him to your righteousness. He's going to influence you before you influence him. So it's a very Mishlei type of moralizing verse. Don't ally yourself with a wicked person. It also reminiscent, of course, of Pirkei Avos, right? Al tischaber larasha, don't join with the wicked. Same type of idea. In number 8, I brought you a cautionary verse about war. And it's very interesting because Shmuel HaNagid's day job was minister of war for some of the Spanish taifas. So look at what he says. Krav dome birisho el yefefe asher kol ish lesachek ba yeave visofo kizkena hameusa asher kol shochara yevkat viyidva. He says, and my apologies because it's somewhat sexist, it's here. War is at first like a beautiful girl with whom all men long to play, but in the end, like a repulsive hag whose suitors all weep and ache.
No.
Sorry. I'm just reading the news. One would hope that with the 1 year anniversary in Ukraine, you know, someone would read this. In source number 9, the last one I'm bringing you from Shmuel HaNagid, this is actually a religious line. And it says, Bisam yirah terafei at chali or libach. Oh, you know what? Sorry, it should be bisam yirah. Maybe tirpa at chali libach veinecha ubelashon maaseh tazdik asher diber lashonecha. Not sure. You could go a couple of different ways with some of the vowels, but his point is, with the medicine that is awe of God, you will heal the sickness of your heart and your eyes. And with the tongue of deeds, you shall make just that which your tongue has spoken. So what he's saying is, awe of God is remedy for sin, and actions are a therapy for speech. Right, if you want to go back to Pirkei Avos, emor ma'at va'aseh harbe, right? Speak little and do much is what he's saying here. So he models it on Mishlei, and Mishlei is enough of an influence that he calls it Ben Mishlei. And you find that trend after this period. So when if you're familiar with Musar, right? Musar are ethical teachings. And there's a wave of great books of ethical teachings in the period from the 11th to the 14th century, and a lot of them draw heavily on Mishlei. So Chovot HaLevavot, Rabachi Ibn Pakuda in Spain is one. The Sefer Hasidim, written in Germany in the 12th century, draws heavily on Mishlei. You may be familiar with Igeret HaRamban, Ramban, Nachmanides, his letter to his son, which starts with a line from Mishlei, Shema b'ni Musar Avicha. And the whole thing is, it draws heavily on Mishlei. There's an anonymous work called Orchos Tzadikim from that period. I did a search in the Bar Ilan CD-ROM text of Orchos Tzadikim to see how many references there are in Orchos Tzadikim to Mishlei. There are 185 references to Mishlei in the book. The book has 29 sort of mini sections, if you include the introduction. It's got 185 references to Mishlei in it. And then when you get to the later Musar works, the ones from sort of the 17th century, the 20th century, also, like Mesillas Yesharim, they're all very Mishlei heavy. It's a book with a major, major impact. We have lots of commentaries on Mishlei. If you take a look at source number 10 on your sheet, and then I'll take questions. If you take a look at source number 10, you find early writers. Rav Sadia Gaon translated Mishlei into Arabic. Rav Hai Gaon wrote about it in his Shir Musar Haskel. And then you look at the Rishonim, the early sages who wrote on Mishlei. Rashi, Rabbi Moshe Kimchi, Rabbi Avraham Ibn Ezra, Rabbi Yosef Ibn Nachmiash, Rabbeinu Yonah, the Meiri, Rabbi Yosef Ibn Kaspi, Ralbag, Rabbi Yitzchak Arama, all of them write on Mishlei. And I've already referred you to, in the later authorities, the Vilna Gaon, the Malbim, even the Karaites got into the act. Yefet Ben Ali, a Karaite writer, wrote a commentary on Mishlei as well. Yes, Susan.
You brought up the Kalebot.
I'm sorry, I brought up what?
How much was the Kalebot?
Yeah.
Influenced by Mishlei?
We're going to come to that very
soon. You see, it sounds so much like what I remember learning of the Kalebot.
Yep. We're going to come to it in a minute or two. So it's a good question. Hang in there. Janine.
This list of people who wrote on Mishlei kind of belies the theory that it's meant for children.
Yeah.
All these great sages wrote about it. It sounds like it's a little deeper than just a simplistic, you know.
Agreed. I mean, they go in different directions with their commentaries on it. So we'll see the Vilna Gaon and the Malbim really try to find great depths and symbolism and so on in it. Not everybody goes that route, but it's true that some of the, Rabbeinu Yonah goes like an entirely different direction with Mishlei. They're all going different ways with it. Yeah, that's what I would say. But yes, they seem to see a lot there. The argument could always be made in response, how much of what they're writing is actually Mishlei and how much of it is their use of Mishlei to convey ideas that weren't there in the first place. You know, that allegation is made. We'll have to see and we'll have to look at that ourselves. Other questions and comments? So the last bit I wanted to do in terms of the legacy, actually next to last, is its role in liturgy. And here I'm going to come back to the Pirkei Avos point. Ashkenazim don't have public readings of Mishlei, right? We don't have it read in shul or anything like that. Victor Hurwitz, who I've been quoting off and on, says that it was done in shuls in Spain before the expulsion from Spain. They actually had public readings of Mishlei, but the practice has not remained. But here's what did. You may be familiar with the practice between Pesach and Shavuos, and we extend it even through the summer, right? I see the hands already, right? Of learning Pirkei Avos on Shabbos afternoon. So Sephardic communities actually had public learning of Mishlei on Shabbatot between Pesach and Shavuos. If you take a look at source number 11, Rabbi Yosef Ibn Nachmiash reports on this practice. He says, V'chei nagu likros Mishlei. We customarily read Mishlei. V'yesh machalken oso l'chamisha prakim shiyeh keneged chamisha prakim shal maseches avos. Some divided up into five units so that it will be parallel to the five units of Pirkei Avos, because you know that the Mishnah in Pirkei Avos is only the first five chapters. The sixth chapter is not Mishnah. It's of later origin. But he says, we divide it up to five segments, Perek v'chelek b'chol Shabbat, and you have a chapter and each Shabbos. U'v'aretz hazos nagu l'chalek oso la'arba'ach alakim bilvad. And in our lands, we have four units. Umagdimin Shabbos Echad Lishnas Bamaseches Avos. And what we do it is we learn Avos first for a week, Uba Arba Shabbosos, and then the remaining four, Mesaimim Avos Umishle. We conclude Avos and Mishle. V'Shabbos Shal Kinyan Torah Shua Shabbos Hashishis, and then the Shabbos of Kinyan Torah, which is when you read the sixth chapter in Pirkei Avos, Noagid Likros Rus. Then they actually do Rus. So they're doing Mishle along with Pirkei Avos, then they finish Mishle, and then they go over into Rus. And why Rus? Because we know that Rus becomes Jewish, and when we receive the Torah, we all become Jewish, so therefore we do that. And this points to what Susan pointed out, which is the influence of Mishle on Pirkei Avos. How you can see why they would lump them together, and the value of having a book of Mishle like this may inform the decision of our sages to create Pirkei Avos. It's modeled on that same type of an approach. It also would explain perhaps something about Pirkei Avos. You know how many times I've heard people say Pirkei Avos is about how to be good to each other? Ben Adam L'Chaveiro. But while it's true that you do have social instruction in Pirkei Avos, you have an awful lot there that's Ben Adam L'Makom, between man and God. And a lot that's about like reward and punishment. And how God is going to reward and God is going to punish. It's not what people think Pirkei Avos is when you actually break it down. I once did an analysis. I broke it down like to how much of it is this and how much of it is it. And it makes a lot of sense in terms of the model being Mishle. Because Mishle, so much of its focus is, as we've said, this view of how the world works and how reward and punishment works. Like it's actually very true to the Mishle model. Mishle makes it into our davening in big, big ways. We could be here forever talking about this, but we're not going to. Instead, if you look at number 12, I just gave you a quick list of some things. When we bring the Torah back, right, after Kriyas HaTorah, after the Torah reading, so if you have your Mishle, you can track along with us here. Chapter 4, sentence 2, Ki lekach tov nasati lachem tarasi al ta'azovu, followed by Eitz chayim hi l'machazikim ba v'somchem u'shar d'racheh d'archeinom v'chumasi. That's all Mishle. Interestingly, we reverse two verses. Meaning, the line d'racheh d'archeinom is before Eitz chayim hi in Mishle. And we flip it. I don't know why, I haven't looked into it. But that's an example of something that is from Mishle that makes it into our prayer. Another example, after Aleinu, people have the practice of saying, Al tira mipachad pitom mishoat rasha'im ki tavo, right? That's from chapter 3 in Mishle. It doesn't sound in context the way it does when it's said after Aleinu, but that's a separate point. Lichadodi includes lines from Mishle. I gave you the references there, right? Shlomo Alevi Al-Kabetz, living in Tzfat, composes this quasi-mystical or fully mystical song, and he uses phrases, not full lines, but he uses phrases that show up in Mishle. So that's interesting. The Hadron. Hadron is the prayer that is said after one finishes learning a section of Torah when doing a siyum. And some of the lines in the Hadron, including the ones that the Mesayim frequently botches and mispronounces, are actually from Mishle. Vakitzosa hisisichecha. That one's always, is always a tongue twister for people. That's actually Mishle. And of course, this list is incomplete unless you mention Eishes Chayil. Eishes Chayil being said in many homes Friday night, that practice, I believe, starts with the Kabbalists in Tzfat in the 16th century. Of course, Eishes Chayil is not originally written about the Lady of the House. We will talk about that, God willing, when we get to learn that chapter, which I hope to spend some time on in the course of our Mishle study. Last note on our introductions. I wanted to conclude with this because I found it very interesting. If you go to the beginning of Mishle, beginning of the book, Mishlei Shlomo ben David Melech Yisrael, right? We went through the opening sentences. To know Chochmah and Musar, to understand the statements of Bina, to take Musar, Haskel, Tzedek, Mishpat, and so on. Sentence 6 is the one we want. Lahavin Mashal Umalitza, to understand the lesson that's being given. Divrei Chachamim Vechidosam, the words of the sages and their chidot. So chidot are riddles. And if I remember correctly, and I don't really, but I am going to pretend I do. If I remember correctly, when we first learned the opening verses, I didn't translate the word chida. I'm going to come back to the word chida now. Take a look at source number 13. Rabbi Moshe Kimchi says, what is a chida? Chida, davar mechuseh. Ve'eino muvan ad shi'eforash, something that is hidden and is not understood until it is explained. Right? Those who learn Shoftim with me, and remember the Shimshon story, the riddle at the wedding. Right? From the strong came the sweet, the whole thing with the honey. Right? It's not understood until it is explained. So Professor Mordechai Zer Kavod, who is one of the editors of the Dot Mikra series on Tanakh, including part of Mishlei. So he says, "Rotzel Omar, Yesh po remiza le'inyan misuyam she'eino galui l'chol shomeya. A riddle, a chida, has a hint to something in particular that not everybody will be sensitive to. Not everybody will be aware of." He says, that's what a chida is. So there are chidot in Mishlei. There are riddles in Mishlei. Yes, Janine, definitely not something that the kids are going to perceive. So here's something that Professor Zer Kavod picks up on. If you take a look at source number 14 from my uncle, this is from Professor Tur Sinai, and I don't know where he wrote it. I have not been able to find where this comes from, but Zer Kavod brings it. He said, "V'gam b'sefer Mishlei yesh lirot et ha'pitgam shelefanenu kikashur el sipur histori midivrei hayamim." He says there are passages in Mishlei which are actually connected to historical events, but shelo huvan. The event is not actually mentioned here; just the idea is there. Ho'olu b'sefer Mishlei nesfu mishalim v'divrei chochma bilavad, because in the book of Mishlei, you're just getting the lessons, the proverbs, the words of wisdom. So it's not anchored in the story that it comes from. But there are passages in Mishlei that are riddles. This is the way Professor Zer Kavod takes it. They are riddles that are referring to things that happened in Tanakh. And Professor Zer Kavod really likes it because of the point that he makes in number 15, where he says, "In kol bin le'umiyuto shel sefer Mishlei," with all of the international character of Mishlei, right? We said it looks like wisdom literature in various cultures and all of that. He says, "V'amishutaf lo l'divrei chachamim lo yisraelim," what it has common with non-Israelite words of wisdom. Hareha ofiha Yehudi shalom mizdaker b'tluto b'hagut shel haTorah. Its Jewish character bursts forth in its link with the Torah's thought. When you can connect it to events in the Torah, now it's very clearly our book. So in number 16, I gave you references to some of his examples. Take a look at Mishlei chapter 22, sentence 11. He has a long discussion of this, but I chose not to go into the whole thing. Chapter 22, sentence 11. Ohev tahar lev, chen sefasav re'ehu melech. The one who loves a friend, in other words, of pure heart, the charm of his lips, re'ehu melech, is a friend to the king, where the king is his friend. A little bit choppy as a translation, but it'll do for us for now. Rabbi Moshe Kimchi comments on that, saying this is a reference to Chushai Ha'arki. If you remember the story of David and Avshalom, Avshalom revolts against his father. David has a very close advisor whose word is treated like the word of God. It's very honored. His name is Achitophel. Achitophel goes over to Avshalom and he gives Avshalom advice. He tells Avshalom, go bring as many people as you can and attack your father right now. He's vulnerable. Kill him now. And he also tells him what to do with his father's wives. There's this whole story. And if Achitophel's advice is accepted, Avshalom's going to win. David is toast. However, what happens instead is Hushai is an ally of David, and he goes over to Avshalom, and he gives Avshalom bad advice. He's loyal to David. He gives Avshalom bad advice. Avshalom takes the bad advice, and as a result, the revolt fails. All because of this royal friend of pure lips. That's Chushai Ha'arki. That's an example of a link between a line in Mishlei and a story in Tanakh. We also, of course, have links between Mishlei chapter 31 and various great women in Tanakh. I want to come back to that. But I'll show you one particular example that will really help crystallize what he's saying. I felt this one I could present without getting too far afield. If you take a look at chapter 27, sentence 14. He goes into this one at length, but we don't need to go into it at length in order to get it. But if you have a full Tanakh, you're going to want it on standby for Shmuel Aleph. Mivarech re'ehu bekol gadol baboker hashkem. If somebody blesses somebody else with a loud voice rising early in the morning, it will be considered a curse for him. Vanessa, you okay? I can't hear you. If someone blesses somebody else in a loud voice, rising early in the morning, it will be considered a curse for him. That's the line. So what he says is, if you take a look at Shmuel Aleph, chapter 15, sentence 12. You could argue with this association, but I don't want to. Vayashkem Shmuel lekras Shaul baboker. Shmuel got up early in the morning. There's that word, hashkem. He got up early in the morning to greet Shaul. This is after the war with Amalek, when Shaul didn't do what he was supposed to do. Vayugad l'Shmuel emor b'Shaul ha'Karmel. Shmuel was told Shaul has come to the Carmel and all of that. He went to the Gilgal. Vayavo Shmuel al Shaul. So Shmuel comes to Shaul in the morning. Vayomer lo Shaul. And Shaul says to him, Baruch atah l'Hashem. Hakimosi es devar Hashem, you are blessed to God. He blesses his friend early in the morning, saying, you are blessed to God, I did what I was supposed to do. And of course, the end of the story is kelalate chashev lo. It ends up being a curse for him. Shaul ends up losing the throne. Shmuel has to tear him down. So you got up early in the morning and blessed your friend. It didn't go well for you. He says that's a hint at the story in Shmuel. Okay, either you got it or you didn't get it. Don't worry too much about it. I gave you on the sheet review questions because we spent a lot of time on this introduction, and I want to make sure we came away with something. Besides, Tochiner said something about riddles and Shmuel and Shaul, and I didn't really get what he was talking about. So let's see if we could get some of the other things. What are the segments, the units of Sefer Mishlei? How do we identify the units of Mishlei? This is very long time ago. This is you know, almost 7 hours ago. Right? We had different options. We had one.
Can you repeat the question?
No, it's on your sheet. Where it says review questions on your sheet. So we said you could go by the obvious headings in the book, where it begins by saying the words of Shlomo ben David, right? And then in chapter 10, sentence 1, it said these are also the words of Shlomo, right? The Mishalim of Shlomo. And then in chapter 25, sentence 1, we said that these are the Mishalim of Shlomo that were recorded by or transcribed by Chizkiyahu's men. That was another unit. And then chapter 30 with Agur bin Yakeh, and chapter 31 with Limuel. Those were the easy identifiers for units in Mishlei. And then we said there are subtler headings potentially, like Divrei Chachamim, and these are also Divrei Chachamim in chapter 22 and chapter 24. We had Aluka in chapter 30. What does the word Mashal mean in Sefer Mishlei? Anyone want to hazard a guess? Not a guess. It's not a guess.
It could be a proverb or a parable.
Yeah. More broad. Because sometimes they're
parables. Educational message? Oh, sorry.
Yeah. Sorry, Ricky, what?
I had the thought. I think I lost it.
Okay.
Mashal makes me think of Lashon, speech.
Right, but it was an educational lesson often presented in a poetic form. We're not inventing new things here. This is just a review of things that we've said. An educational lesson often presented in a poetic form, and there are a variety of poetic forms. Sometimes it has two halves, sometimes there are three parts, sometimes it's multiverse. Not the same thing as multiverse, sorry. Multiverse across multiple verses. What is the overall message of Sefer Mishlei? Pursue wisdom. Use it to become righteous. And so benefit the world. Right? That was it. That was it in a nutshell. And maybe earn valuable prizes. I think that's in there somewhere also. I should include that. Earn valuable prizes along the way. Why do we view Mishlei as more than a regular book of human wisdom? Why don't we just treat it as general wisdom literature?
This is Jewish.
What makes it Jewish?
I'll think of something.
Okay. So we said it's attributed to Shlomo, whose wisdom is divine, right? Like we saw in Malachim. It's associated with Chizkiyahu's group, who spread wisdom, and it's canonized in Tanakh. So we don't look at it as just like, okay, here's another book with some advice, Poor Richard's Almanac or something like that. There's more here. We asked, if Shlomo is the author, then who are Agur bin Yakeh and Lemuel?
Also Shlomo.
Right? Other names for Shlomo. That's all. We then asked, why do some challenge the attribution to Shlomo? Why doesn't everybody accept that? So one reason was because it's considered too legendary. Just Shlomo, as he's described in Malachim as being able to do everything, and it's too much for people to accept, even though we have leaders like that. Also because there are ideas in the book that appear in other cultures, right? Especially that Egyptian Amenemope work, which we talked about. The ideas in the book sometimes seem simple. And the book names other authors, although we said they could be Shlomo, but they're named Agur bin Yakeh, and Aluka, and Lemuel. How might we reconcile Shlomo's authorship with the ways that it is similar to wisdom literature in other cultures? How can you harmonize that? So we said that it could be a response to wisdom literature from the Torah, which is why it's important for Tanakh. Tanakh responds to other cultures in a range of ways, right? We talked about the Rambam showing that certain mitzvos are meant as responses to ideas that are elsewhere. We talked about a whole bunch of things. I'm not going to go through the entire thing, but it could be that this is our response to their wisdom literature. How do we understand Mishlei's apparently simple advice and simplistic view of reward and punishment? How How do we deal with that?
We saw that it's not always as simple as it looks, but we could also consider that it might have been written for either children or just not to be revealed to everybody, not with deep messages that are for everybody.
Right. So we had said that maybe in fact there are deeper ideas here and everybody can benefit from it, and the commentators do identify layers. It could be it's instruction for the young, and that's appropriate for Tanakh as well. We also noted the idea of poles within Tanakh, and how Koheles and Eov are giving you one extreme, and the other extreme is Mishlei. We had that as well. Yes, Ricky.
Also, it shows us an idealized version of what we should do and what the world is. Not should be taken literally, but
right.
It's just an ideal way of looking at it, and we should strive toward it.
Right. It's setting a narrative, we said. Right. That's part of why it would be valuable for adults. And then finally, some of the signs of Mishlei's influence. We talked about now its use in Agadata, its use in Halacha, its influence on post-Tanakh writings, including Ben Sira and Ben Mishlei, the many, many commentators, its power in the Musar books, both older and newer, and its relevance in the Siddur, you are correct, Gita, and the fact that communities did learn it. Avigdor Hurwitz, who I've been quoting, has a lot more on that, on the communities that learned it. So what I want to do next week, I see you, Ricky, hang in there. What I want to do starting next week is to pull some specific passages to show you how they've been learned. We could be spending a lot of time on this. We're not going to, because we have to get to Koheles. But we want to spend some time at least getting an understanding of some more of the text itself before we go on to Koheles. I'm also going to remind everybody, Purim is Tuesday, March 7th. We will not have a shiur that day. So just to be clear, you're all welcome to come to my house and we can talk about Mishlei. Ricky, you were going to say?
When you said earlier that between Pesach and Shavuot, some places study, what is the form of this study? How do you study it? I mean, we studied it with you. But how do you study it in groups or in terms of...
So I don't know what they're doing. Often, though, in a shul, there's a shiur on Pirkei Avos. So Mishlei could be done that way. Sometimes it could just be everybody is sitting there between Mincha Ma'ariv and they're learning it themselves. It could be people learn it in their homes. That's a very popular thing to do with Pirkei Avos.
But learning is reading.
Well, reading, but reading and getting an understanding of. Look at learning it with commentaries, the way we do it here. But, you know.
Oh, with commentaries.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Yes, Gita.
Rava said people should reside with those who resemble them.
He didn't say people should. He said people do. Right?
And
you're looking.
Will reside. Oh, will. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Thank you.
Sure. Thank you. And it's not Rava, it's Ben Sira. But yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
Okay. Thank you very much, everybody. Be well.
Thank you.